by asking a few questions. We'll start off by asking just a few questions. How long has Paul been in custody? Dos años. Okay, 2 years. 2 years. And where has he been held for the last 2 years? What city in particular? Mm-hmm. Caesarea, right there on the Mediterranean coast there, and Judea. And who most recently heard his case? What rulers? And it's not just one in this case, was it? We had two leaders with the names that started with F. Which one of the two? Festus. Very good. The first one was Felix, right? And he's the one to whom Claudius Lysias had sent Paul. And who was the other leader? And his wife, or sister, or both, that were present in whenever this went on, this last... That's right. I can actually. When I know the answer, I can read lips. But if I don't know the answer, I'm terrible. So, yes, it was Agrippa. So, thank y'all. All right, I didn't want to go too deep into... Just kind of orient our minds for just a moment. We're going to go on a journey tonight. A very interesting journey. A perilous journey. And maybe as you've looked at this journey, you've asked the question, why did the Lord see fit to record so many details? I've wondered that before about this passage. You know, the Bible's generally very compact, uses a very good economy of words to describe things, but there's a lot of details in these next two chapters. And so it's a reasonable question. Why? Obviously the Lord chose this to be recorded this way. We're going to study it just like we would any passage. We might come to it and think, well, there's not a lot of great spiritual truth in this passage. Why would the Lord see fit to use so much real estate in the Scriptures to describe this? But I think there's some very good answers to that question that we can see as we go through here. Several different answers, all of which, in my estimation, are correct. Before we get into it, though, we'll look at that question here again in just a moment. We're not in a drop dead sprint this evening, so we can go over these. The 17 periods of Bible history. Now, we're not going to go over them in great detail. We just want to see if we can say them. So familiarize yourself with the list again. We'll just go through it here. Before the flood, scattering of the people, patriarchs, Exodus, wandering in the wilderness, invasion and conquest, Judges, United Kingdom, Divided Kingdom, Judah alone, captivity, return from captivity, years of silence, life of Christ, and early church and letters to the Christians. Now let's see if we can do it the hard way. And we'll go slow because I panic whenever I can't think of it instantly. Before the flood, the scattering of the people, patriarchs, Exodus, wandering in the wilderness, invasion and conquest, Judges, United Kingdom, Divided Kingdom, Judah alone, captivity, return from captivity, years of silence, life of Christ, early church, and letters to the Christians. And we know that there are different ways to say those. That's just a way. But that does encapsulate the body of Scripture, the narrative, the history of the Scriptures. All right, so we ask this question, why so many details? And I don't really think I fully appreciated that, and maybe I don't fully appreciate it now, and I will someday, but I do appreciate it a lot more after studying for this class, the God's wisdom in doing this. There have been lots of skeptics over the years about Scriptures, been skeptics, most notably those that rose in the 17th and 18th centuries in Germany, and they were technical in their critiques of the Scriptures, and they raised questions about what about these people called the Hittites? We don't know anything about them, but the Scripture talked about them. Well, subsequent to those criticisms, great deal of information was found out about this people that lived north of the Mediterranean. Hittites lived up in this area, and they traded. We have records, secular records, of them trading with the Egyptians. So the scriptures were vindicated. But one criticism was on the details in places like Acts chapter 27. Well, let me just cut to the chase and tell you the scriptures have been tremendously vindicated. There's a lot of details that are touched on in this chapter about travel, about the Romans, about how goods went around in the Mediterranean. There are details about how long it took to get from one point to another. Even in the storm, those points are relevant, and we're going to look at them to some extent. But what they do is, people who have approached these and looked honestly at them, skeptically. C.S. Lewis, for example, he was a skeptic, and he was essentially an atheist, and he came to prove that Luke wasn't a first-party witness to what had happened. And after studying through his accounts, he was convinced with good evidence that Luke was a first-hand. And I think you'll see that in this chapter tonight, there's no way these details are even second-hand. Even if they were true, they're not second-hand. They are the witness's view of what happened, the way he records them. And of course, books as far back as Horae Paulinae used the complete and very intricately woven details and the facts, the way they overlap in great subtlety between the epistles and the Acts, to show that indeed Luke was the writer and Paul and those that are mentioned as contemporaries in these events were indeed that, because they recorded in such detail. And the obvious details, Paley makes out the point that the obvious details are easy if you were trying to trick somebody, but it's those little bitty subtle ones, that's the one. So that's one reason. Another reason that we can see is we can see how in everyday life, even under very adverse circumstances, how Paul and those with him, their character grew to cause those, or didn't grow, the respect of those who were traveling with them under these adverse conditions grew. For them, they began to have more and more trust in the things that Paul said. And also, as you notice through here, there's an awful lot of where Paul is, he's talking. I say an awful lot. There's quite a few references to where Paul is referring to his faith in God, and he's referring to what he believes will happen with absolute confidence. And it's a great testimony to God's power to these people when what Paul says will happen, that God has revealed to him, does happen. So that's some of the reasons. All right, so the journey is going to be, it's already really begun in a sense, because Paul was taken into custody. We said the third journey ended at Jerusalem. Paul was taken into custody there, taken by night to Antipatris, and then further up to Caesarea. And so the journey tonight begins from Caesarea. Paul has, what has Paul done that got him on this journey? What did he do in that last trial? He appealed to Caesar. As a Roman citizen, he had that right. And as Jimmy pointed out, there were a few options that Felix and Agrippa had, but they chose the option of letting go. Well, the first question that's answered right off the bat here is, who's on this trip? And we can see, I made light of a couple here, the we in verse 1, the us in verse 2. Paul is being accompanied by at least Aristarchus and, of course, Luke, who's recording all of this. So when it was decided that they should sail to Italy, this is after the first half of the year, it appears. So we're starting to get into late summer. Probably we're already into early fall at this point. There are some ambiguity about how many days the trip from the coasts of Cilicia over to being off from Cnidus. We'll see I'll just back up and show that. This part here is just is summarized by many days, so we don't know exactly how long that took, but we can make some approximations that it's late in summer, early in fall. When it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. This was a special regiment, evidently, that was attached to, probably, those who were responsible for taking care of things under the emperor's charge, such as moving prisoners sometimes. And these types of soldiers would be stationed all over the empire. There's no secular mention of these so much in the first century, but they're mentioned pretty widely in the second century. So a little bit of ambiguity there, but they were entrusted to this Julius of the Augustan regiment, and they entered a ship of Adramidium. Yeah. And they put out to sea, meaning to go sail along the coast of Asia. First, they're going to sail north to Sidon. Aristarchus, now, do you remember Aristarchus from Ephesus? What happened to him there? Aristarchus and Gaius both had something happen to them. That's right. Diana of Ephesians. And Aristarchus and Gaius were there. So he's with Paul. He's mentioned being with Paul as a travel companion in several places. And here he is with Paul. He was from Macedonia, in Thessalonica in particular. The next day they landed at Sidon. This was between 60, 70 miles north of, maybe as much as 75 miles north of Caesarea. So, you know, there's one of those details. Could a ship, a skeptic could come to that detail and say, could a ship make it that far? And the answer is, absolutely. The currents along this area flow south to north. Basically, they flow south to north here, and then they flow back around this way. With a westerly wind, which is evidently what they had during that time of the year, even today, typically your winds are from the west or from the northwest. And given the current, it was very unusual for ships to sail south here along the coast. So as a coasting vessel with the current with them, they wouldn't have to have gone very fast at all to make 70 or 75 miles in a 24-hour period. 3 miles an hour would not be unusual at all for a ship. And of course, ships don't stop and take breaks, so they make time pretty good over the course of 24 hours. And so there's a little detail. 24 hours, that's about what it would take, or a day. All right, so they got to Sidon. And notice here that Paul was treated kindly by Julius. And that speaks automatically. We don't know if Julius had been familiar with Paul before. Perhaps he was. But either way, he was impressed with Paul to the extent that he gave him liberties, entrusted him in a way that he wouldn't trust your average prisoner. Remember what the Roman law was. If you're a soldier and you're responsible for a prisoner, what happens if that prisoner escapes? Your life or his, typically, unless there was some mitigating circumstance. So Paul had a tremendous amount of trust. I don't expect that he sent him over there by himself. He probably sent him with a guard or two. But the point is, he treated Paul kindly and he gave him liberty to go to his friends and to receive care. We don't know if Paul was... Maybe he had... you know, we mentioned in Galatians that when he was with the Galatians, that he says, I bear witness that you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. See what large letters I have written. Paul had a thorn in the flesh. We don't know what it was. It's possible that he needed some care. Maybe that's one of the reasons that Luke travels with him in many cases. We don't know that, but he did receive care. Maybe it was just general hospitality. When he put out to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. That is, they're headed to Rome. So the most logical direction would be to take out from Sidon here and go straight this way. But if the winds were from the west or from the northwest, that would be between difficult and impossible. So instead, use the currents and tack to some extent along the coast. Now, let me just mention this because it's going to come up quite a bit here in the next little bit. The kids may not be familiar with sailing ship. They're going to think about motorized ships, and they need to be instructed a little bit about what a sailing ship would do and how it would deal with adverse circumstances. But one of the things that a ship can do, it can do something called tacking or beating against the wind. And what it does, the wind, and a good ship can do this up to 35 degrees from into a due wind. For example, let's say that the wind is heading this way. And this is the way we want to go, directly into the wind. Well, what the ship will do is they will first tack this way for a distance. And what happens is, if you kind of take your hand, it's counterintuitive in a way. But if a sail sits like that, and if the wind is coming this way, it hits it in such a way. Well, the pressure is higher here than down here. So what's going to happen is the wind is going to hit it and go this way. It's not going to hit and retrograde back up the sail. And what happens is that puts pressure on the sail. And because you've got a rudder, and because that vector, for lack of a better word, is going to push the boat first that way, the boat's going to slide through the water in the general direction that it's pointing. So you can actually make the boat go in the direction that is contrary to the wind. However, you will not go 0 degrees. You will not go directly into the wind. You will go generally about, between 45 degrees for an older vessel, probably like this one. And some of the newer vessels can tack at 35 degrees. So you would tack toward a point that you weren't necessarily that interested in, but it like closer to where you're headed. Then you would tack in the other direction, all the while zigzagging and making your way to where you were going. Sometimes that's called, if the wind, let's say your destination's here, then what you would probably do would be called beating against the wind. You would just go like this and then come in. But if you turn about like that, that's called tacking. So that's what they would have been doing, tacking against the wind when it became difficult. And it made it slow. It's a trip of 100 miles could become a trip where you traversed a linear 200 or 300 miles. So it was difficult. So they sailed under the shelter of Cyprus. And the reason being, if that wind were coming from the west, off the Asian continent and off Cyprus, the landmass would interrupt that flow and provide them with more favorable winds. When they sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, they came to Myra, city of Lycia. And there the centurion put them aboard an Alexandrian ship that was sailing to Italy. It's interesting to note that Alexandria was right here, and this was a great seaport for shipping grain. Rome was very, very dependent upon the Egyptians for their grain. To the point that in the wintertime, they ran short a lot of times of grain. And so the Romans would offer a reward, a bonus, so to speak, for getting grain to them late in the season. Now, the man that's on this ship that they're about to enter, they traveled from Alexandria. They've been in the same general conditions as these from Paul's group have been in. And so they would have had a west wind as well. And they would have tacked, to some extent, it would have required much less tacking here to go straight up to Myra. A lot of ships did this. This was a well-established thing in secular history. What we learn in the book of Acts here is perfectly consistent. In fact, we learn a few things we wouldn't know elsewhere. But what we do know from other sources about the size of the ship, how people could buy passage on those ships, the type of sails that were on it, the types of rudders that they used. They're described in this chapter. They had two oars, for example, and they had a mainsail, and they had a foresail, it looks like, and the way that they would strike anchor. All those details covered, very, very consistent. So at some point in time, as they're making this trip up, the ship laden with grain, wheat, comes up to Myra. And they're making their way across from Cilicia, across Pamphylia, and over to Lycia. So they're here. And that's where they change ships. And when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete to Salmone. All right, now, I should have put one of these a little bit later in my slide so I didn't have to go back and forth. But you can see, again, that if the weather is such, the wind is such that as they come around here, when they cleared this landmass here, they're in a pretty open sea. A lot of wind would have come down the Aegean and would have made, if it's a northeaster, or I'm sorry, a northwest wind, or if it was a prevailing west wind, it would have been impossible with a vessel of this size to make good time coming across here. So instead, they, as you can see by our illustration, you can make pretty good time. In fact, it's something that's really not intuitive, is that you can make better time with an angled wind coming back from either from 90 degrees or maybe 80, 70 degrees. You can make better time than you can with a dead wind in front of you, or behind you, rather. And that's really counterintuitive because it puts more force and can actually make better time, especially these modern ships. But at any rate, so because of that kind of consideration, instead of, you know, the kids might say, well, why didn't they just go that way? Well, the wind was blowing against them. Well, you said they can tack, yes, but very slow. They would have made pretty good time coming down this way. Now, it would have been a bumpy ride because this is very open. You know, on our map it doesn't look like that big, but if you've ever been down at Calford, you know it doesn't take a lot of water for the water to get rough. This is plenty of water for it to get rough. So this would have been a difficult trip across there. Notice Salmon in here. They're going to come around here to Fair Havens. All right, and they passed with difficulty Salmone, and now they, if you notice back in your mind, they're having to face into that wind again, and they arrived with difficulty at Fair Haven near the city of Lycia. I want to say, I read somewhere it was about a 2-hour walk, and that's one of the reasons this is not a place they would have been excited about spending the winter. Now, much time had been spent there. Now, we could imply by that they had killed a lot of time when they should have been traveling, but more likely they've been watching the weather, and this prevailing wind continued. This prevailing wind again from the west. See here. Now let me back up a little bit here. This is where we're at. We're right here. So you can see in my slide that's kind of poor graphic quality that this little dip in here is going to be the area that's going to lie fairly largely up here, and that's where the port of Phoenix would have been. But there's a little peninsula out here just to the west of Fair Haven. So it would have been difficult here if that wind were coming out of the west, northwest. But when you came around here to get to Phoenix, if it were blowing hard, it would be very difficult to get up here to Phoenix. So they waited there evidently for that reason. And because of that, time went by and it became more and more dangerous. Today, the big modern ships, they can sail when they get good and ready to go, these big ships. But back then, generally around November the 11th, they quit sailing, and they didn't sail again on the Mediterranean, on the open sea, until sometime in mid-March. So, Paul, you remember 2 Corinthians chapter 11? Paul mentions having spent a day and a night in the deep, having been shipwrecked. That was before this. Paul, his advice, some of the things he says, they're not by God telling him, okay, this is what's going to happen. You know, this ship's going to be lost or whatever. He says, I perceive, here in a few moments we're going to see that. Paul's advising them, but it's based to some extent on his experiences, I think. Now, much time had been spent, and it was sailing was dangerous. The past, this would have been the Day of Atonement. We're talking about mid-October now. Paul advised him, saying, men, I perceive that this voyage will end in disaster with much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives. Well, the Lord's going to tell him later, they're going to lose the ship, but they're not going to lose any of the lives. That is an explicit revelation from God. But here, Paul said, I perceive. Paul had probably suffered enough to pay very close attention to what was going on at sea, and he knew that this was dangerous, what they were doing. Now, they weren't trying to go a long, long way. They just wanted to get up to Phoenix, evidently, to harbor there because it opened a little bit more favorably out to the sea. But they didn't listen to him. At least the centurion didn't listen to him. Julius liked him, but he didn't listen in this case because it was under his control. The ship's owner was with them. The helmsman, both of those wanted to go. And the centurion was persuaded, let's go. Of course, the ship, the owner, as we mentioned, he probably had a big prize waiting for him. He owned not only the ship, but if this is the normal situation as it was then, he would have owned the grain that was in the ship. So he was on the hook for a lot of money, but he could make a lot of money. So he wanted to go. Whether or not that they thought they would make it all the way to Rome before the season ended is not perfectly clear. They had to get to Phoenix first. Well, the harbor wasn't suitable to winter in, and the majority advised to set sail from there also if by some means or any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. That would have been there's a deep water harbor in that area that opens in those ways, and that would have been much better, and there was a city much more nearby, much closer, if it's the one we think it is. And one day that south wind blew softly, and supposing that they had obtained their desire, they put out to sea and sailed close by Crete. But not long after, a tempestuous head wind arose called Euroclydon. And this word, Euroclydon, Euro is means east, Clydon, excuse me, meaning north. This was a northeaster. Now, when we think, let me go back here for just a second. All right, if the wind is blowing, we've already said the prevailing wind is in this direction, either west, northwest, west-northwest, or north-northwest, west-northwest. But here we're talking about a wind coming from this direction. And you can already see here that the next section is going to bear out that that's how they went. This is Cuda or Clauda, Cauda or Clauda, this little island here. It's going to be mentioned in just a moment. So this is a very interesting little section of the journey that's about to happen. And it's happening because of this Euroclydon, this northeaster, very, very tempestuous. Well, what that would mean, as a general rule, on land, it's not just a sailor's thing, but if you feel the wind at your back, you can take your hand and point to your left, and that's the area of low pressure. So if there's a storm and you have the wind to your back, the storm is to your left. And in this case, that would mean that the storm would have been centered off of the northern coast of Egypt. They're going to be concerned about the Syrtis. There are two sets, by the way. There's the greater set is in this area of Syrtis sands, and there's also a smaller or lesser Syrtis sands in this area. Probably the one mentioned in the passage is here. They were very concerned about running aground in these sands. They would have shifted around. Their location would have been uncertain at times, so it would have been very hard. Any questions or comments or thoughts? Well, not long after they left the harbor, this headwind arose called Euroclydon, and the ship was caught. Couldn't head into the wind. We let her drive. And in that sense, they let the wind be behind them. They faced lee wind. And they let her drive. Now, in this case, they would have probably dropped the main sail and just had that smaller foresail up in the front. And they would have used their two oars in the back, the steering oars, to let her to keep it pointing in the direction they wanted. This was easy. This was not hard. Just let her drive. She's going with the wind now, and running under the shelter of an island called Clauda. We secured the skiff with difficulty, and when they'd taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sand. they struck sail. Now this is a little uncertain, this wording here, on struck sail, and so were driven. Here they may have put out sea anchors. You could take stones or heavy weights and drop them down to the water, and what they would do is they would slow the vessel, keep it from moving as quickly. It would mute the effect of the wind itself, and it would also accentuate the effect of the currents, because the currents would have an impact in that area as well. Anywhere when you're on the water, you have to take into at least those two considerations. So they dropped that, and they struck sail, and so driven. All right, let's look at this for a second. This is interesting. We don't have a lot of time, as I was thinking we would, but the details that I read about this, the distance, it says that when they left their havens, they came around Cape Matala here. They were somewhere between there and Phoenix Harbor when this Euroclydon arose, probably not a long way. This would have been about 35 miles from here to here, so maybe they're 10, 15, we don't know, miles in. This track pulls them right under Clauda. They did that intentionally. Then they get here, and they take the skiff. These big ships would have had a skiff behind them, a smaller ship, a smaller vessel, open, not huge. They took it aboard, and then they took cables, and they undergird the ship. They bandaged it up, so to speak. They would take it and pass the cables underneath the frame of the ship, and they would tighten them to the extent they could. That would hold the ship together, because they're going to be in some very heavy winds. And that's when they let these anchors over. Or if an alternate reading is taken, that's when they set the foremast. Now, what they did at this point, maybe you're thinking, well, this shows them going west. Everything shows them going west. Malta, where they're going to end up, is about 8 degrees north of where, due west from where they are. So if we got a Euroclydon going, there's two questions that come up. Is 14 days reasonable for that trip? Is that how long it should have taken? And how did they get there? Well, again, using these principles that we're talking about here, they would have set that foresail like this. That would have pulled the bow. They would have used their oars to face north with their sea anchors set. The currents would have impacted them. And you put all of those factors together, trying to tack to some extent. If they had motors, they would have went north. So they got that bow point north. There's almost no question about it. So as this wind comes, they're trying to keep the bow going that way, not get beat to pieces, and stay off these Syrtis sands down here. So you put all that together, they were probably making about 1.5 to 2 miles an hour, which would bring you to Malta in 14 days. So that is just interesting how all that works out. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lighted the ship, and on the third day we threw the ship's tackle overboard. This would be the block and tackle, the pulleys that you would use to, you know, you don't just yank an anchor up. You don't just take a foresail or a main mast and move it around. You don't take a boom and just move it around. You need leverage and bodies. This ship had 276 people on board, but they used leverage with this tackle. Well, it's hard to run a ship without tackle, but they were desperate, so they took the tackle. Probably not all of the tackle, but any spare tackle they would have had, they threw it overboard. And when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat upon us, all hope was given up. They finally gave up. Now, I don't think Paul or Luke or Aristarchus felt this way, but I think this was probably the general mood of the ship's crew that's being described here. And after a long abstinence from food, Paul stood on the midst of them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me when I told you not to leave. We wouldn't have incurred this disaster and loss. But now, take heart, because there's not going to be no life, loss of life among us, but only the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you.'" I would imagine that was a pretty cheering message in the middle of that distress, if one was inclined to believe this prisoner, this Paul, whoever he is. But do you think they've been watching Paul? I think they probably have been watching him. And some of them, I suspect, believed him. "Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe God, Paul is stating his faith. Now remember, after they're shipwrecked, a lot of these people are going to end up believing. God's got them in mind. However, we must go aground, run aground on a certain island. And when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, now somebody would say, that's not the Adriatic Sea. But it was then. They considered this whole area from Tyre all the way down, almost down to Egypt. Down to Sirtis and Cyrenia. Now I'm wanting to think what's the other name of the city, but I can't do it. Anyway, but they considered this whole area to be the Adriatic. So today we don't consider it that way, but they did. About midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. Okay, now don't pay close attention to this. This is really fascinating to me anyway. They were drawing near some land. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. A fathom is 6 feet. So this would be... this would be 120 feet. And when they had gone a little further, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern. This was unusual. Generally, you drop them from the bow or the prow. But this was done, but it was unusual. They dropped them from the stern, and they prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they let down the skiff into the sea under the pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, that is, from the bow of the ship. The idea here is you can't have too many anchors in the water because we do not want to move. Typically, these old anchors wouldn't hold very well, but there's some interesting characteristics about where they are off of Malta here. So they were going to put those out. At least that was their pretense. But really, they were interested in trying to take that skiff and get into the shallow water. They could likely hear breakers. They might even could see them in the dark. If you've ever been in the dark near a real tempestuous sea, you can look and see the breakers. They're white. They scare you, but they're there. They're visible, typically. And you can hear them a lot of times over the wind and waves. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Now, I said, pay attention to they said they were going near some land. This is a blow-up of the island of Malta. It's on the northeastern side. Now, we've said that they would be tacking at this point in time about due west or just slightly north of due west. So this point, they would have passed by this point. This is the bay, and there's almost no doubt this is the bay they would have hit because it's the first part of the landmass they would have come to. And everything in the description fits this bay perfectly. So the water out here, incidentally, is today about 20 fathoms. And typically, if you were doing this, you would think about it with respect to land. But the funny thing is, as you come out into the mouth of this bay, it actually shallows up. So this point would have been the point they would have heard breakers. The waves would have been coming from this way, coming this way or this way, so that they would have heard that. They would have, it says they sensed that they were near land. Well, there were plenty they could sense. They could probably hear or see those breakers. So they took soundings, 120 feet. Went a bit further out in here, about 90 feet. Very consistent with the way it is today. The other thing that's interesting about this bay is, unlike a lot of bays in the Mediterranean, it had a clay bottom. And the anchors would have stuck ferociously. The British naval archives records lots of details about this bay, and that's one of the things that's noted in their archives, is that this bay had an unusually sticky bottom. So they set the anchors out from the back. The bow would have been facing this way. This would have been the place where the two waters met, water from here and here. You'd have a tide. And let me tell you, a tide, when you mix a tide with waves, and from two directions, it can make some crazy things happen to the water. So that's where they probably got stuck, is right in here. One of the things that happens is you generally get a sandbar. So it appears that may have been what they hit. They got the ship stuck right about there. Well, the waves are still coming from back in this direction. So the rear of the ship was being beat to pieces. And the centurions, they wanted to kill the prisoners because they were afraid if they escaped, they would have to be put to death. So
the centurion, Julius, wanted to save Paul, so he kept them from their purpose. Again, this speaks highly of Paul's reputation among them. He kept them from their purpose, and he commanded those who could swim, jump overboard first to get to land, and the rest should go overboard on boards or parts of the ship. Not everybody could swim. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. I'm going to go backwards here for just a moment. Paul here, in talking to him, he says, today is the 14th day you have waited. This is verse 33. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment for this, for your survival, since not a hair in the head of any of you. When he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken bread and began to eat, they were all encouraged. So I can, that wouldn't encourage me one bit if I didn't have some confidence in this man. And I would expect that Paul, if you've ever been on a vessel in a storm, in a bad storm, and you think you're going to die, you're about 90% sure you're going to die, you get really scared, and people don't act brave. Paul was acting calm. Paul was acting, not necessarily brash, but he knew. He trusted God absolutely. So his behavior would contrast. Well, I'm sure that of Luke and Aristarchus would have contrasted so much with what everybody else was doing, scurrying around, afraid, mourning, that they were encouraged. So they took food. And that's what we found, that there were 276 people on the ship. Very, very unusual that so many people could be on a ship that was effectively being beat half to pieces. The front half does not appear to have been beat to pieces, but they all made it to land safely. An amazing trip. A lot of details that I passed over in there. There's a lot that has been written about what those details mean in terms of proofs for the accuracy. I touched on a few of them, but it is really amazing. I didn't realize it until I studied for this class. I don't think I handled them pretty well with you guys, so well with you guys, but they are there. It's amazing. And I think that's one of the main reasons the Lord gave us these details on this trip. Any comments or questions?